So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Joe Taylor, who is former Director of Talent and Talent Management, no less, at TalkTalk. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Really good. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. So, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and a bit about the work that you do and also kind of done, I guess, because you've just finished as former.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have, I would say, an eclectic CV. Mm-hmm. And I use that word not lightly because I started my career as a journalist. So I started my career at the BBC making TV programmes like Watchdog, Crime Watch, sort of holiday programmes. And I think the thing that epitomises me and kind of what I enjoy doing mm-hmm. is storytelling.
Right.
And telling interesting stories through people.
Okay.
So whether you're making a TV programme and that's going out at prime time, 7 o'clock on BBC One, or you're putting a colleague experience together for TalkTalk around how we recruit, how we retain, how we develop the best people, mm-hmm. you're basically telling a corporate story.
Right.
You're trying to engage people in why they should work for that organisation, what are you going to bring that is different, and why you want them to stay.
Sure. Okay. So that's really interesting. Storytelling, corporate storytelling to effectively attract talent, to engage talent, to build talent, to grow talent, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, but that sort of reminds me that there's always, there's this, so I was thinking about, when I was thinking about the interview and, you know, mining the depths of your experience, that there's a quote that kept coming back to me, and it's a famous Peter Drucker quote, which says, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast."
Yeah.
And that was one that gets kind of like trotted out from time to time.
Yeah, all the time.
And everybody goes like, yeah, we know that, we know that. But it's just really quite hard to do that. And I think, what's your view on what it takes to, one, do you believe or do you agree with the quote? And two, what does it take to deliver that sort of high-performing kind of culture, that dynamic kind of culture, the evolving kind of culture?
So there's lots of articles at the moment about culture. I actually wrote a blog recently about how to devise a corporate culture.
Right.
And for me, it's not a thing. Culture isn't a thing. It's a mindset.
Ah, okay.
And a mindset is driven by everybody. It's not just driven from the top.
Right.
So for me, strategy is set from the top. The business priorities are set by the exco or the board of an organisation.
Yeah.
And that determines what the business goes after, ultimately. You know,
sure.
Are you going to launch a new product, a new service, are you customer-centric, whatever that might be. But the culture doesn't necessarily imbibe what you're delivering.
Right.
Culture is, I think, driven very much from a mindset of the values, the sort of secret sauce of an organisation, whether that is...
Is it like the how?
Yeah, it
part
is.
Part of the how, the, how
it
you
is.
Do it?
Yeah. Okay. It's not just what you do, it's sort of how you do it.
Okay.
And one of the recent articles that I read that I really enjoyed was by Josh Burskin from Deloitte.
Right.
And he talked about how do organisations build simply irresistible places where people want to work.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about sort of five different factors, which I'm obviously not going to remember them all because I'm on the spot, but I will give it my best shot. The first was around management.
Right.
So this was around autonomy. Permission,
mm-hmm.
The opportunity where people get to be managed by really adult people. The second was around environment, the sort of working environment. And I'm not talking about the Google Slides or the sort of free
food
and and all of that. Because for me, that's cosmetic. That doesn't make a culture,
right.
Ultimately. That's the aesthetics. That's what you put into an organisation.
Right.
But an environment, and what I mean by that is, when you walk into an organisation, do you know, without seeing any logo or anything about that, does it feel like that company?
Right.
So if you walked into TalkTalk, would you know that it sold phone and broadband, mobile, fibre and TV just by going into reception? Or would you know by sitting there in reception the type of people that work there?
Right. Okay.
There's environment. There's, I think... The third one was reward and recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So So this is not, people are, you know, that they, you talk about the multi-generations of talent coming through into organisations, and now colleagues want an experience, and reward and recognition is a really key way of driving a really great experience and driving a really high touch culture.
Yeah.
And I don't mean just the money that you give, it's things like, do you give people time off to do charity sure. work? Do you create flexible working? Do you create different pieces of kit, you know, that choose your own device or bring your own device type of mentality?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's that was the third. The fourth was leadership, and that's about vision and purpose.
Okay.
Do you understand the vision and purpose of that organisation? Are the leadership really authentic? Do they sort of sit in front of you? And the fifth, and I think the most important, is around career development.
Okay.
Do you feel that you can develop your career within that organisation? Are there opportunities? Are they transparent, open, and honestly advocated? So therefore, in driving a culture, it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. Mm-hmm. If you've got those five components, it's how you choose and where you decide to rank them. Because for some organisations, they might not be worried about environment. It might not be something, you know, in Silicon Valley, for example, you know, you've got the pick of people to work for. You've got queues, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, don't have to advertise at all. You've just got thousands and thousands of people wanting to work for you.
But you know, I'm pretty sure they probably wouldn't stay very long if you put them in a concrete bunker.
They wouldn't, but at the
and
end
that
of
wouldn't
the
fit with kind of Google's kind of like
no,
that
but that has been built, but that had, that environment was very well thought through. That came before understanding what Google's culture was.
Sure.
They the people at the top of that organization decided that they wanted to create this campus environment.
Mm.
Other organizations are much more interested, so like a Unilever or GSK are more interested in how you can drive career development around global mobility and spend a lot of time thinking about global mobility, more so than whether it's on the M4 corridor or not.
And does this link into when firms talk about their EVP, sort of their employee value proposition?
Absolutely.
And I guess if you have those five elements, the EVP is a bit like old school graphic equalizer. You have different sort of levels.
Yes, but I think an EVP pulls the what and the how together.
Right.
So when you're looking as a candidate, you understand what that company does and how they do it, and you can see yourself reflected. So therefore, so people like Lego do it brilliantly on their website, because they talk very much about what Lego's philosophy is, but they also talk about and show very clearly what it means to work at Lego.
Sure.
So they show pictures of the offices. They have videos and podcasts of different people at different levels. So as a candidate, you can either decide to opt in or opt out. And I think that's what a lot of companies forget. They put a website up which is very intrinsically linked to their products and services, but people aren't necessarily interested in their products and services. They're interested because they hear it's a really cool place to work, or there's great career development, or there's great CSR, or there's great leadership.
Yeah.
And that's what I think needs to happen. You need to join the two together.
So companies need to remember that they're selling to two groups. They're selling to their customers, but they're also selling to their potential employees.
There's cross-sell. Yeah. There's definitely cross-sell, and the best companies have the cross-sell opportunities by, someone like Innocent.
Yeah.
Innocent Drinks do it really well. You know what Innocent stands for, then you go directly through, there's a job, work for, you want to work for us, and it looks and feels very similar to their corporate site.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're going, right, this is a congruent company that gets and is very confident about who they are and why they do things.
So that sort of so there are some companies that kind of have their careers kind of like sites that end up getting outsourced by other people. So you go into the careers page and it goes, here's all a list of things, and you click and it goes on to some other sort of like CV processing, sort of uploading, sort of like sort of site. You look at it and just go, wow, crumbs, really? And it just all feels a little bit distant.
Yeah, because every
just because the brand's not go all the way through it.
Well, what a recruitment company does is they go and buy an ATS, an applicant tracking system.
Right.
And they'll buy it from Workday or Taleo or Jobvite. And what they won't do is they won't spend the money to
sort of rebrand the UI. So, yeah.
And it's really interesting because me leaving TalkTalk, I've kind of been really looking at this because I've been a candidate now.
Right.
So the amount of jobs that I've applied for through LinkedIn, you know, is in probably in the 80s.
Right.
And the ones that I kind of feel more synergy to are the ones that just literally use my LinkedIn profile and I can attach a CV. But the ones that make me go through an application, which is probably 10 or 15 minutes at minimum sometimes, that I feel as if I'm a cog in a massive wheel, I'm less likely to be engaged with or even get a call back from.
Well, exactly. You're not sort of, you can tend not to be sort of inspired kind of by it and things. And I guess in a way, you've got the candidate experience, employee experience, and then the customer experience is a lot of all this kind of interlinked and things.
Well, if you think about it, if you go onto Amazon and you can do one click in terms of a book or whatever you're buying, it should be exactly the same for recruitment. It should be a one-click process because actually everybody should have a CV or everyone that is, majority of people now, I don't know what the percentage is on LinkedIn, but the majority of people that are looking for work between probably 21 and in their 50s are on LinkedIn as having a professional profile.
Sure.
One click.
There you go. There's a challenge to all you kind of like organizations are recruiting out there right now. But this also reminds me, and we go back to the sort of culture thing and the five different elements. I mean, I'm assuming that you agree with those kind of five kind of elements. Is there anything else that you would add to it, or do you think that's a good list?
No, I think it's a good list. I think you can reword it. So when I've talked at conferences, I've probably reworded them. I don't know, and I probably put more emphasis on, for me, management and leadership and career progression than I have around the sort of working environment and rewards, because that's my passion, that's something that I feel very connected to and have had lots of experience in. So it's but I believe that if you join all of those five elements up, you can have a simply irresistible organization, and I really like the phraseology of it.
Simply irresistible, irresistible organization, yeah.
Because it's just something really positive. Mm-hmm. I think when you talk about culture and strategy, for me, my heart sinks. Because I kind of think about massive PowerPoint presentations and the kind of, you know, the kite marking, a great place to work, and times 100. And for me, that doesn't make a great place to work. What makes a great place to work is the people and how you really unlock the potential of those people. And it's everyone's responsibility. Everybody has, it's like the culture code. Everybody has the key to unlocking culture. It doesn't sit in the domain of EXCO.
No.
What it means is that EXCO have probably a higher proportion of responsibility.
Yes.
But ultimately, if you're a first line contact center manager or talking to a customer, you have to understand the culture and the strategy as much as an EXCO member who may be remunerated or rewarded in a completely different way. And that's what I don't think companies get. They spend the time focusing on the top 100 to really unlock, because get them managing the business and forget that the moral majority of a business is at the lower levels.
And that's where the largest part of the customer interface is.
Exactly.
So, I mean, but then all of that reminds me of that. So I interviewed a guy a while ago called Chris Evans. He's written a book.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the importance of having, in all of this, and I think it's all knits together a lot what you're talking about, this organisational constitution.
Yes.
But then he goes on in the book and says, in the first line of his book, he asks a question. He says, is your workplace frustrating and lifeless, or is it engaging and inspiring? And he says that many people say that their organization is somewhere in between. Mm. But when you find that situation, he said he advocates sort of starting with, like, we need to build a constitution. It's almost a bit like, it reminds me of an American, kind of building in America, that they started with the constitution. This is what we stand for.
Yeah.
I mean, would you agree with that?
I would. I would, because I think it's really important to understand the what and the how. And we've talked about this before. Yeah. You know, what is the business there to do? So if it's there to make money for shareholders, let's be honest and transparent about it. If it's to serve, you know, to be customer centric, let's be honest about it. But how you do it, whether you're, you know, at whatever level, is just as equally important. So it's the meshing, it's that whole jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting book, so sort of feeding off, you know, what your guy was saying, Reid Hoffman, who...
chairman of LinkedIn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's got a really he's written a really interesting book, which was published by Harvard Business Review, called The Alliance.
Right.
And he talks about companies being like an army.
Okay.
Now, I don't necessarily agree that they should be an army and everyone should be marching to the same tune, because I think that takes away individualism, it takes a diversity of thought.
Yeah.
But what I really liked about it was he talked about the honesty and putting the honesty back into the relationships that organisations and people have within them. And he talks about it simply as companies invest in the market cap of individuals. Let's be honest. Mm-hmm. We borrow talent for the time that they work for us. Sure. And we're really lucky that great people have worked for me and yeah. I'm sure for you. But we borrow them for the time that they're there. So we're investing in their market cap, because they'll go and work for another company. And a millennial might work for 12 or 13 different companies in their lifetime. So you've got to kind of have that mentality that you borrow people for that time. But those people are also investing in the market cap and the productivity of that organisation.
Sure.
Now, if those two are running at completely different speeds, then what you've got is a disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And what he talks about is actually, if you're honest and transparent about that transactional nature of relationships, the sweet spot is the alliance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Of those two. So if you believe that I invested in TalkTalk for the time and they invested in me, then they've wished me well, and mm-hmm. But that's absolutely fine. And therefore nobody feels ripped off, nobody feels as if one is taking the mick or anything like that. Whereas if you go along with these two on a different speed, then you're always going to have disconnect. Mm-hmm. You're always going to have disengagement. You're always going to one is going to feel at a higher or lower entity. And so I really like that kind of mutuality, because yeah. what it breeds is a culture of trust and permission.
Yes. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's kind of fair. I think and I would translate that back into there's another interview I did with this guy who is called runs a cellular company in the States.
Okay.
And they've given up contracts. They have a no contract business.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say that it keeps them alive to the fact of kind of what they're doing for the customers every day, mm-hmm. day in and day out. It's the same sort of like kind of deal from an employee.
It's a deal. What's the deal? Whether that is in terms of reward, whether it's in terms of leadership, in terms of permission, in terms of career structure, it's the deal. And that's what your guy is talking about, that contract. But I don't think you can call it many different things.
Contracts, standards, philosophy, kind of like constitution, whatever it might be.
But it's being transparent about it.
But it's also been articulated as
yes,
well.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree. And if you look at what the CEO of Zappos has done recently around taking away, he said we're not going to have management anymore.
Yeah, he's trying to move toward a holocracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily a massive fan I'm not sure it works.
Yeah.
But I actually like, I think the vision and the purpose and the honesty around it is something to be admired.
It's like something that W.L. Gore has been playing around with for years and doing extremely well out of, but they don't talk much about it.
No.
They do it, but they don't talk much about it.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating kind of thing, but the Zappers are completely, almost not completely, but very, very transparent kind of company in terms of what they do.
They have a group on Twitter and on Facebook, I think, and on LinkedIn, where you can be a Zappos insider and right. you can see what they're doing, and therefore they don't have job alerts, they don't you can sign up to see what they're doing, so you can have a look at the team day that they might have done in Las Vegas, right. or kind of have a look at a team meeting or those types. So you're getting a real inside of you of that organisation, and then you can decide whether it's for you or for not. And I really admire that transparency. I think it's brave. Whether the sort of the internet or the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs can be that way, because I don't. But I'd like to see more examples of that happening in more corporate organisations.
Sure.
And so all the examples that I'm giving you are from businesses that have got an e-commerce angle, and it would be amazing to see businesses that, you know, like a Barclays or, you know, that are long-standing, sort of take the shackles off and slightly take more risk.
But there are companies that have done that, or rather, I think they've got to the point where they've achieved a bit of a steady state, as yes. it were, and yes. a steady state of excellence.
Yes.
And I would say that people like the John Lewis's of this world, yes. that are kind of up there, but then that's what people are aspiring kind of to. There are the people like the W.L. Gore's, but they're much written about, but they don't talk much about themselves, okay. which is unfortunate, but I mean, they're going, well, it's our business and that's the way that it is. But it'd be nice to learn more about kind of how they do that as a way of inspiring other sort of like firms.
I definitely think that, you know, one of the ways that I absolutely learn is from different experiences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking on SlideShare or following people on LinkedIn and talking to people like today, you know, mm-hmm. we're kind of sharing thoughts and ideas and everything like that. I don't think what I do is particularly complicated. I think people can make it very complicated. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what you're doing is you're helping people unleash their potential. Potential for what? That's up to that individual. Mm-hmm. What I do is give them the opportunities mm-hmm. to be able to do that, and present it as a coherent story.
Yeah. Okay. So when we talked earlier, you mentioned in relation to the sort of the people and talent sort of yep. like strategy and culture and things, you talked about sort of pre-life
yep.
and early life experience yep. and things and how that all plays into it. And can you explain to me kind of what yep. that's all about, because that all sounded a little bit medical from my
so I've got this philosophy that talent management or people strategy should be treated in the same way as when you launch a product or a service.
Right, okay.
So when when you research buying a new sofa, mm-hmm. for example, you will go on to a website or insurance or so. You go onto a website and you'll kind of look at the recommendations. You'll sort of talk to your friends and family and you'll kind of build up a picture. You're going to the shop.
Yeah.
And your kind of experience, if it's John Lewis, a really nice experience, whereas if you go to DFS, it might not be so much. You'll experience the kind of good and the bad. And then when you live with the sofa, say...
Not that we're saying that DFS is categorically bad.
No, not at all. But if you're...
You get different business models, a different experience
you get the sofa home, carrying on this analogy, yeah. whether it's working or not, and something goes wrong with it, and then you think about what the service. So for me, whenever you're talking about people or talent management, what you're trying to do is create a story.
Right.
So the pre-life, I'm talking about whether someone's contacted through an ad, go through the website, whether they're contacted through a recruitment consultant, their experience tells them and gets them excited about working for that business.
Right.
And that it's seamless. So we make it easy. So go back to the one click.
Right.
Right? So then you've got that person hooked and you offer them the job. And in early life, I'm talking about the first 90 days.
Right. Okay.
So do you know, they've got 3 months notice. Does the manager call them before, keep in contact? Do they get invited to team meetings? Do they get a wadge of papers to sign and it becomes really annoying and they don't hear from you? When they come in, they're left in reception for 20 minutes. Yeah. That whole 90-day experience makes you go home to your partner or tell your friends and family, I made the right choice.
Yes.
Then your in-life experience is how long do you see yourself staying in that organisation? And that is determined by the development opportunities. Do you have an opportunity to upskill? Can you navigate your career? Do you feel that you've got good opportunities for reward and recognition?
Sure.
And what lots of people, companies do is they spend a lot of money in the in-life experience, very little in the pre-life, because they think, oh, well, it's we're I don't, you know, Channel 4 felt this, you know, we're Channel 4, we should just be able to get out, or the BBC, get our pick. But no, not in this market anymore. And then what also people forget is when someone leaves, whether they resign or whether they kind of get another opportunity or they leave through a restructure, how are you keeping in contact with that person? Do you have alumni groups? Do you have a referral program where if you refer somebody, you get a fee for doing that? Deloitte do that brilliantly.
Yeah.
You kind of have that whole alumni network. They never have to advertise because they get, you know, they've always got their referrals. And so what I'm saying is that if you treat it as a product, what you shouldn't do is just spend your time thinking about each product element. You should join it up.
So that reminds me of sort of the relationship marketing cycle. So you talk about attract, engage,
exactly,
serve, retain, refer.
Exactly.
And it goes and it maps very completely onto that.
Exactly.
So it's actually about relationships over kind of time. I mean, there's another example for you that there's a company you talk about, Deloitte, that do it really well with their alumnus network and things. There's another company that do something really interesting around when employees leave for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Whether it's downsizing or they're, you know, or they're disciplinary or kind of whatever it might be, you know, sometimes the negative side of people moving on. They this company's called Happy.
Oh wow.
Which is and they started in computer training, but they've gone into
Happy Computers.
Yeah.
I know Happy
Computers. Henry Stewart.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you know what their policy is when somebody leaves?
No.
They go and find them another role.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Because something might have happened, even if it's a disciplinary sort of thing, and they have to fire somebody, they feel it's incumbent on them to help that person
to
take the next step.
That's lovely.
And give them that sort of level of support and be really sort of sincere about it. So it doesn't feel like you're just abandoning them.
Yeah.
And that creates so much more positive sort of feeling and great feedback that comes back to them, because then they're always creating ambassadors for their firm.
I think that's amazing, and that's just something that I think when you work for big companies gets forgotten. And there's lots of services, there's lots of outplacement services that when you are made redundant, but it's quite a scary thing to put yourself into the market, regardless of whether you wanted to leave the organisation or whether you didn't.
Sure.
And those organisations that make that transition, you will always hold your imagination and will also hold your attention. So that if someone, you're down the pub with somebody and they say, oh, I'm really looking for a really job in IT, you go, I left there, but contact this guy at Happy Computer because I loved it for my time there. And you know, that can save you huge amounts of money in terms in recruitment. The more referrals that you get, the more efficient your resourcing model will become.
Imagine the sort of the ideal sort of perfect scenario where you have a business which is completely referral based, both from a customer perspective and also from an employee perspective.
Be amazing.
So you do no marketing and have no recruitment, external recruitment costs, because everything's done by referral.
Well, that's what Glassdoor, in a way, it doesn't do, but Glassdoor is a way of checking out companies that I think companies are not necessarily grasping.
Mm-hmm.
So what Glassdoor is you can go onto it and I can look up TalkTalk and it can give you, would you work there? And people write, and a lot of people think it's just negative people sort of mouthing off. But actually what I think companies should do is to start to have much more of a dialogue with the people that are blogging on there.
Yeah.
And I think it can create a different vibe. The more the companies that actually start a bit like TripAdvisor, coming back and saying, look, I'm really sorry for your experience, do you want to come in and talk about it? I think you go, they really care.
Sure.
Whereas if you just become a name on a blog, disgruntled such and such from whatever, it becomes less authentic.
Yeah. So If I was to say, if somebody was sitting listening to this or reading the highlights, and they said, right, fine, I'm in that sort of space, or I'm an entrepreneur or executive, and I know I want to get more out of my talent. I know I want to give my sort of the whole culture and people a bit of a an adrenaline sort of injection. Where would you say that they should start? Does it go back to the what and the how again?
I think it starts from the business. I don't think talent and HR can ever not start from the business priorities. I think you have to really understand what the gap, what the stretch is between what you've got and what you need.
Okay.
And once you figure out that, then you can work out what talent or HR you need.
Okay.
But if you don't understand what's going to be different in 3 to 5 years, or even in as short as 18 months in some of, high, PE-backed businesses, then you can't get the right people working on the right things and doing the right things, because ultimately you don't know where you're going to. And so you'll run around chasing your tail.
Yeah.
So it has to start and finish by the business. That's why people employ people like me,
mm-hmm.
because ultimately what I do is I help the business drive their bottom line by helping them unlock the people and understand what they've got and what they need going forward, and then create a strategy around that.
Okay. Perfect. So my final question, which I always ask,
mm-hmm.
is there anything you would like to shamelessly plug?
No, I don't. I think for me, there's three words that kind of sum up, I believe, who I am and what I stand for in talent management, which is bravery, brilliance, and boldness.
Mm-hmm.
Bravery, because I think you have to...
Is that talking about yourself? So you're brave, brilliant, and... Well, what was the third one?
Bold.
Bold. So you're brave, brilliant, and bold.
Yeah, I think I am.
Brilliant. Joe has kind of got a reddish, kind of purple hair, kind of like style right now. To match your top, I hasten to add.
Yeah, so I think that sums up who I am, and that sums up what I believe really strong talent management strategy should all be about.
Fantastic. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome.